Well, you were saying that the split that Du Bois refers to, you were explaining your attitude toward that notion.
Yes, you asked the question.
Yes.
To some degree, in paraphrasing, was the situation where there is a desire for Negroes to retain Negroidness, and the question of assimilation into American culture would inevitably destroy that image. My position is, I don't really care which develops. I would like to be considered on par with any other man in America. To have been born in America, I think that there are some rights that are mine because I was born in my father's house. There are perhaps some rights that others who come over as aliens and become citizens in that fashion, there probably should be and are some requirements that they should have to meet. But as a human being born in America, I think that we should be free to associate with whomever we please. If we want to live in a community and it's our desire that, if it's a Negro's desire, that he perpetuate as best he can the culture of the African or the Negro, well and good. On the other hand, the American that wants to be a part of the mainstream of American life and accept his friends because he liked them rather than because of their race, who perhaps develops in time to come a situation where Americans become tea-colored, I don't think that it would cause me to have strong feelings either way.
The situation is similar to that. This is a parallel, but there are many solutions to the other question too. The Jews I know talk about this division of impulse, either in themselves personally or in this general Jewish situation. Is there a difference between the Negro situation in this respect and the Jews, do you think?
No, I think that when we're talking about Jews, maybe we sort of lose the fact that many of the present-day Jews of my generation are not nearly as great adherers to the Jewish traditions as others. I recall an experience a year ago. Met a Jewish lad at a convention, and he and I got to be pretty conversant. And at lunchtime, the hostess brought around ham salad and chicken salad. Well, I just knew that this kid, being a Jew, would, in all probability, take chicken salad. So I ordered chicken salad, and he ordered ham salad. So I looked at him, I said, "Boy, you can't eat ham, you're a Jew." He said, "Well, I'm just about as good a Jew as you are a Christian." So, and I have found this kind of light batter in many of the Jews of which I find it possible to be conversant with. And I find them just as loosely connected to the orthodoxy of Judaism as many Americans are religiously, I say, connected to the preparation of races. Now, in some Negro communities, you'll find there will be the woman who will not groom their hair, straight, but will let it grow in the its natural form. Well, it's all right if you do, and it's all right if you don't. And I think that this kind of reaction, or this kind of doing or not doing, ought to be put down simply as a cultural trait of a particular individual and does not connote, not denote anything superior or inferior, but it's just as simple as some people like to wear red ties and others like them black.
When do you think the image of the, quote, new Negro arose?
Well, I think it perhaps Langston Hughes is the author, I think, of a little ditty that gave rise to this stereotype new Negro just after the Supreme Court decision in 1954. When he paraphrased an old song by Stephen Foster, Old Black Joe, and he said, I'm coming, yes, I'm coming, but my head is bending low. I hear the gentle voices calling Old Black Joe. Langston Hughes did it this way. He said, I'm coming, yes, I'm coming, but my head isn't bending low. I'm walking loud, and I'm talking proud. I'm America's new Black Joe. And that sort of caught on. Because it's easy to say, it's easy to remember, and it gives you a sense of buoyancy. And with the 54 Supreme Court decision, I think that the somebody-ness that the Negro has sort of acquired of himself.
It had been a long preparation, though, for that, hadn't there, legally and otherwise?
Yes, sir. The decision came some 7 or 8 years, you know, after the legal work had begun. So it was, although it came about in 54 as a decision, this gave, shall we say, authenticity or legality to the dream and the hope that the Negro was not biologically and in any other manner inferior to the white group.
A psychologist told me this some months ago. New Haven's having a community planning program, rebuilding certain sections, rezoning, new housing projects. And in connection with this, they are investigating attitudes of various minority groups in the city. That's what they want, what image they have of themselves,
yes,
that sort of thing. There's a test called the Rumor Test. It runs as follows. A picture is shown with four or five persons in it. One here, say, in the foreground, being a white man, a Negro there, and somebody else there, somebody else there. But the white man is holding a knife in the foreground, or sometimes a razor. Now, this test is given to a group of whites or a group of Negroes. The first person looks at the picture, and the picture's put away. He's supposed to tell number two what's in the picture, then tell number three, and the two tell three through 10 or 15 people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Invariably.
You get it all wrong.
Get it wrong.
Yeah.
The person holding the knife is one of the Negroes.
Well,
this has a, it's a very strange fact, but apparently this psychologist who knows that the giving of these tests in New Haven assures me that it's true. What does that mean?
I think that the stereotype here is perhaps answered in jest by Dick Gregory, and of course I think that Dick has brought quite a bit of the humor and to some degree the solution to the problem in his banter and humor. Dick said in regard to the fact that the Negroes usually were depicted as carriers of knives is largely because the white people won't sell us no guns. And it's a sort of get even weapon because you can buy a butcher knife in any store to carry home to use in the kitchen. But I don't know how this image of the Negro has proceeded over other nationalities. I see about as many white fellows with knives as Negroes. I think that in our community, a Negro would come nearer being arrested for having a knife than would a white man.
I'm certain that's true.
And therefore we get more publicity about having knives than the whites do. Many of the things that a Negro gets arrested for, the white man is either chastised and sent home or nothing is said at all to him about it.
But in any case, here in New Haven, far away, a significant number of Negroes have accepted this white man's stereotype of the Negro.
I think this is important too. Mississippi is not a mutation in America. The bigotry that exists in Mississippi is perhaps more overt than exists in New Haven. But this question of racial prejudice, this question of white supremacy, frankly, the question of white supremacy is present throughout the Western world and American and European culture. Wherever Western culture is involved, you have a system of white supremacy. Show me a Negro in the legislature of England, France, Italy. Wherever you have Western culture, why, I don't know, but there is always an accompaniment and existence of white supremacy.
Undoubtedly true. Of course, there are no Negroes in England, no significant number, nor Italy.
Well, they said that there are some in Russia, too, and of course I have no feeling of kindness toward communism at all, and I haven't seen Pravda exporting or espousing the Negro cause to the point that you see Negroes in the Presidium either.
No.
See?
No.
So this image of white supremacy is not at all confined to Mississippi. It's nationwide, to some extent worldwide.
Do you feel that when this thing is true, as James Baldwin said, and has been said by others as well, that the Southern mob, beat on the streets of Jackson, Little Rock, mm-hmm. or New Orleans, Birmingham, does not represent the will of the Southern majority?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that many of the people in the South are not permitted, because of real or imagined fears, to espouse the goodness that they really feel in their hearts. Political opportunism causes the expressions of racial bigotry to the point that many people feel that they can't win an elected position unless they espouse a cause of racial hatred. And when you study the history of Eastland and Vardaman and Bilbo, you will find that in many instances these men sired Negro sons or Negro children by Negro women, which gives you to understand that they really didn't hate the Negro, or he would have found himself far away from it. But the question of the fact that Negroes are not registered to vote in any appreciable number gives rise to the political necessity of espousing a cause of racial hatred if the politician intends to win at the ballot box. Now, once the Negro acquires the right to vote, you're going to have a whole lot of white people talking about how good we were to Negroes even back then, and how we felt about Negroes even then, but were afraid to say it. Now, I think, though, that we go back to our feelings of Christianity here, and this sort of is unbelievable by the white majority, too, that the Negro really holds no vengeance about what happened yesterday. If they will really just begin now to act right, they'd be surprised how fast and how quickly we forgive. But the white man is afraid that his deeds are going to follow him. And he feels that once the Negro gets in power, the Negro is going to remember all of the dirty deeds that he's gotten from the white community, and therefore he continues to prolong the day as long as he possibly can, that he will have to suffer for his crimes. In other words, this old eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and a man reaping what he sows. But if we, when we do get suffrage, get the right to vote, it is our determination to really show America how democracy can really work, and how the freedoms that we seek for ourselves will be definitely shared with everybody else, because we realize that freedom is a peculiar kind of a commodity. You can only keep it by giving it away. The only way that a man can be free is to express and give freedoms to all of the other people that he comes in contact with. And this is a general feeling among the leadership of the Negro community of which I'm in contact with. None of us have the vengeance and the hatred to carry.
This is the general feeling, you say?
Yes, sir.
You don't think it's confined to persons approaching middle age or older? It would apply to the young, too?
I think it applies very much to the young. I think that the question of being sure that all people enjoy the rights and privileges of an American citizen is perhaps more imbued in the minds and the hearts of the young than in the old.
Even when they are not Christians?
Sure, even when they're not Christians. I don't think that it takes a Christian to feel this kind of responsibility. It takes a person to some degree that have experienced difficulty to know what it's all about. Now, I think that the greatest ally that the Negro gained during his whole crisis was the white enlisted man that served in World War II and in the Korean War. This white man went to the army never having experienced any kind of segregation or discrimination in his community. And here he goes into the army and he finds that the PX system is so arranged that what comes in is first sent to the officer's PX and they get what they want. And then it's sent down to him. And the quarters on the base where the officers live is so much better than the quarters that he lives. And he got to see what segregation and discrimination means. He realized that when it was doled out to him, he didn't like it. And he began to have a greater appreciation for the fight that the Negro is making, trying to get rid of these same oppressions. And look at the broad spectrum of white support that the Negro has in his cause for freedom, and you will find a great majority of it comes from veterans of the World War II.
Many of whom, I've been told, had their first chance of knowing the Negro personally in the army.
That's true, in the service. They only knew him as a servant, in some servile
occupation.
Many had never seen Negroes, certainly, and only knew them about what they had read about them or what they had heard about them, and usually this was in derogatory terms.
You're a businessman. What do you find in Mississippi or in other places that you know of Negro anti-Semitism?
If this is anti-Semitism, I'd like it to be defined as such. In the fight for human dignity, we have never underestimated our position. But we have overestimated our support. We felt that naturally we would have the Jewish people on our side. We thought naturally we would have labor on our side, because the enemies of all three are usually found in the same group. Here we don't have the Jews supporting us.
In Mississippi?
No.
But you do elsewhere?
Yeah, elsewhere. Frankly, the president of NAACP is Jewish.
Yes.
And Kiva Kaplan, one of the most ardent workers in the NAACP, is Jewish. And it was this image of Jews as we knew them on the national level that caused us to feel that we would, could count on the Jews
in Mississippi.
In Mississippi. And here in our hometown, we have absolutely no support from the Jewish community. Frankly, some of our greatest oppressors are found in the Jewish community, which saddens me, which is a statement that I am sorry to have to make. And if that's anti-Semitism, then we have learned it reluctantly. We would hope that that would be a fact that we would not learn.
But you don't generalize from this. This sort of situation is local roots. That's the assumption you're making about it.
Yes, locally. And frankly, when we are exposed to a Jewish person, there is this feeling that he is a friendly person. And we accept him as our friend until and if he conducts himself in a manner that says that he's not. Frankly, it will never be the Negro community that will be responsible for not being able to get along with the Jewish community.
Do you think that the Mississippi Jews, for instance, because slightly more vulnerable than Gentiles to social pressure, that's why that they react?
I would think so. I would think that they know that once the white man clobbers the Negro in submission, that he's probably next. And it's to his advantage not to become involved in the problems of other oppressed people. But it would be hard for me not to become involved in the problems of a person who's being oppressed without regard to what his race might happen to be.
Well, of course, we know that in general, the Jews have been very great supporters for the civil rights movement and for the Negro movement in particular.
Yes. And that's why I say it was a question of overestimating our support.
Yes, yes.
Here in Mississippi, because we assumed without asking that certainly we can count on the Jews. But that has not been the case morally, financially, or any other way.
Do you notice any difference in attitudes of white people in general, say under 30 and over 30? Is the younger generation changing its attitude on the race question?
I'm sorry, I can't. That's a thing that I would like to believe. But when I observed the riot at the University of Mississippi last year and observed boys who had fuzz under their chin who had never begun to shave and girls who still wore too much lipstick, not knowing how to really be well-groomed. In other words, kids between 14, 18 years old. And realizing that these kids, from the day they were born, many of them, had heard only that the Supreme Court decision of 1954 was not the law of the land. It need not be obeyed. And this had been drummed into the minds and hearts of these kids from their formative years. Now, the average kid that's in college now was between 15 and 17 when the Supreme Court decision of 54 was passed. And all they've heard since then was they didn't have to obey it. And here they're faced on their own college campus with the presence of a Negro, which goes against all they'd been taught. And there they began to throw the bottles and the bricks and the racial epithets and the curses, which said to a lot of people that the sociological and the psychological utterance that we had taken too long to be a truism, that the younger generation will straighten this thing out if only given a chance, did not follow the lines of the writer.
Depressing thought.
Yeah, it is a depressing thought, but I think we have to, I have to express it as I have seen it.
Sure.
As much as I would like to say that certainly we can count on the younger white to be much more tolerant than the older white. But when you realize that the greater amount of the violence, the bricks that are thrown, the people who are knocked off of stools and sit-ins, the kids that bombed our house between 19 and 22.
You identified them, did you?
Well, I did not identify them. They were captured.
Oh.
The same night.
Yes.
And we understand that each one had between 500, we had about $500 in his pocket.
Planning to do it?
We think so, when they captured him.
Otherwise, where were they guy?
Yes, we are a kid that young. But still, that is that image of youth, expressing and acting in a method of racial intolerance, says to me that we're not home safe even with the youth.
I've heard it said that it'll take the Bryant sect developing back here 10 years. These people who were a whole generation in colleges now growing Mississippi with this in their ears.
The riot?
The riot and the attitudes that made the riot.
They said Mississippi back?
Yes.
I don't think that at all. I think that the riot has really propelled us into what can become a new era. I said that because prior to the riot, our contact on the campus, University of Mississippi, was next to nothing.
Yes.
Since the riot, almost weekly, sometimes daily, there are student and faculty persons who come by just to exchange ideas and views on particular issues. These students and faculty members would not have dared be seen in the company of the president of NAACP prior to the riot. Frankly, the riot actually freed them.
Well, that would seem to prove that there's something for they said, to be said for the younger generation there.
Well, I accept that many of the people who take this opportunity are not necessarily young people.
I see.
Many of them, it's a mixture of old and young.
But some young.
Some young and some old, yes.
Yes. How much contact, in terms of civil rights movement, do you find between the more prosperous middle class, as it were, upper class Negroes and the masses of the Negroes? Is there more communication now in recent years than there was, or less?
There's more. And I think that the reason that there is more is because of the involvement of the younger Negroes, the teenagers, who are the sons and daughters of this older, middle-class, black bourgeois Negro. And once mama's red-haired boy is in jail and has been slapped around by the police, regardless of what he's there for, she becomes enraged and becomes more amenable to the civil rights struggle than before. And one thing that the white policemen have not been able to do, they have not been able to differentiate between the child of the Negro that has set the image of stereotype in a community and the Negro that is now striving, making the stride toward freedom. And because of that non-distinction, the Negroes now take the position, from another cliche, that if we hadn't been in the bed together, we wouldn't be in this jam today, which says that we're all Negroes, we were involved in the same strawberry patch, and we're in the same jar jam. So So therefore, we might as well act like it and try to work together to get out of it.
And it's unified the Negro group, made a group identity possible which was not there before.
Yes, sir. It has the overt activities of the white community has done more to unite the Negro community than any other thing.
That leads me to another notion. There's, where does leadership come from? What social bracket?
It's not indigenous to any strata.
It's not.
You'll find the leadership personnel will range from persons who can't read and write to people with PhDs. And the person who can't read and write would have just as much persuasion over the group that he is involved with.
For the natural force and natural intelligence.
Yes, sir.
But there's no real danger then of a break between leadership and the masses.
No, sir. I don't think so at all. I think that the
fear is sometimes expressed, of course. It's said to be at least a problem. A danger.
What really happens is the leadership finds out which way the mass wants to go or what the mass want to do and then go get in front and lead it. But the fellow who lives on the plantation, who digs the ditch, who makes a dollar a day and sometimes nothing, is just as much concerned and many times more concerned with becoming free than the man who's a little bit better off. And the identity of all of us with this particular struggle, regardless to strata, I don't know just how it happens except that take a minister in a pulpit. He is no more a leader to the PhD than he is to the little child in catechism. Each one follows him, you know. So I think, too, that the position of the church in Negro life, where we have this democratic kind of society, has had and will have in the future great bearing on the surgence toward freedom of the Negro community.
What church do you belong to?
I'm Methodist.
Methodist?
Yes. And we're moving too slow. We've got the segregation within the Methodist church that we've got to get rid of. As you know, in the Methodist church, the jurisdictional system prevails. All Negro churches, wherever they are in America, are certified to the central jurisdiction, while there are other four geographical jurisdictions into which the white churches fall. And we're working hard within the Methodist Church to rid it of the jurisdictional system and thus get away with segregation within the church.
Are you making headway?
Yes, we have come to the point where there is much discussion. This will be one of the main topics that will be discussed at the annual convention this year, and there has been some relaxing of the barriers wherein if a church wants to leave a conference and the conference to which it wants to go will accept it, a vote, majority vote by each will effect the move, but it's going to have to be relaxed much more than that. And simply go into a geographical division, and that's what we are contending for.
Are you finding any significant support from white Southerners in this?
Yes. The white South, the white ministers, well, the white ministers of which I'm in contact, and that would be largely those that are concerned with the division of Christian social concern within the Methodist Church, of which I find myself fairly often in their presence, are quite concerned about ridding the church of the jurisdictional system, thus giving them a church doctrine or a legality to preach the brotherhood of God, brotherhood of man, the fatherhood of God. Right now, as long as we've got the jurisdictional system, this says to the white congregation in the South that the church condones this segregation. And once we rid the church of this tailor-made excuse, then we can begin to make progress without the law saying that this is the church's position.
Yes, I see the relevance of that jurisdictional rearrangement.
Yes.
It's sometimes said, and I have a quotation here from a Negro sociologist and historian to this effect, the Negro's plight in the South will be lightened substantially only when the plight of the poor white is lightened, when these two can no longer be pitted against each other in hatred and contempt.
I think that's pretty much a true statement. I think that the power structure and I can speak about Mississippi because I know it best. The power structure of Mississippi for too long has manipulated the Negro against the poor white and the poor white against the Negro. It has told the Negro every time there's a crime committed by a white man against the Negro that there was a redneck that did it. It wasn't us up to date white people. Oh, no, we don't do that. It's the rednecks. And they have told the white, illiterate, poor man that every crime, particularly a sex crime, that's committed by a Negro, upon a white woman, that it was a Negro that did it. And of course, they do this because sex is the thing that the most limited mind can comprehend. And that's the scarecrow that they use. You got to keep these Negroes in their place or they're going to take all your women. Now, to me, that's a serious indictment on the part of the white male toward his white woman, to feel that the only thing that's keeping her from embracing every Negro she sees is because the white man keeps his foot on the Negro's neck. Frankly, if I were a white woman, I would be completely insulted by this line of reasoning. And this thing about Negro men seeking insatiably the association of white women. Now, most Negro men that I know wish to God that our white brothers were satisfied with their own women as we are with ours. And you can hardly come into any Negro neighborhood at night without seeing some car with a white man circling, trying to find some Negro lady to have pleasure with. Well, now, I take this position. If she wants him and he wants her, that's two people's business.
Private affair.
You want to get married, that's still a private affair. I take quite a dim view on the legality of my state that negates the possibility of holy matrimony between the races, but does nothing about adultery and fornication. And they use these types of expressions about the Negro to the white and about the white to the Negro that keeps us apart. Now, I think that the best thing in the world that could happen to Mississippi would be somewhat a wedding of the Negro and the poor white, a populist movement that would break the stranglehold that the power structure of the white community now holds over both the Negro and the poor white. And there are only two divisions between the poor folks in our state. There's poor white folks and poor colored folks. And I think the sooner we realize that, the better off each of us are going to be.
Do you see the immediate prospect for the economic competition between the competition for jobs, between Negro laborer and the poor white laborer, or even a little higher level?
Yes.
The struggle for economic advantage in a state which is poor doesn't have enough jobs to go around.
I think that the pay scale that is now used as a threat to everybody is a prostitution of the labors of the white people, in that the white employer says to the white worker that if you don't agree to work for this $1.25 an hour, I'm going to hire a nigga for 75 cents. And the attitude is not to get the best for the whites of our community by the power structure. The power structure is only content to be sure that what the white man gets is better than what the Negro gets. Not that he's aiming at ultimate say for either group. I think that when employment is based on ability without regard to race, creed, or color, that this in itself will create a situation where industrial personnel will be willing to come into our area, and with it will bring additional jobs and will perhaps create many more jobs than there are now.
As the race situation has prevented the industrialization and the bringing of new plants.
That's my feeling. That's my feeling, sir. And I think that when we break this stranglehold on race, that there will be many more jobs than perhaps enough jobs to go around.
Is it noticeable, Mississippi, that some Negro businessmen and some others who have more or less privileged positions actually oppose the civil rights movement? This is true in some localities.
You know, I don't see how. If a Negro say he opposed the civil rights bill, there are either two things present. He's either a liar or he's a fool. He might say that he opposed the civil rights bill because he is speaking the language that someone who can do him a favor would want to hear. And he enhances himself, possibly, limitedly, in his estimation. But to be against the civil rights bill is to be against yourself. And it's hardly inconceivable that a rational, truthful man could take a position against the civil rights bill.
Well, in a St. Louis paper, the president of the Negro Business Association wrote an article saying that integration would set back Negro business in St. Louis by a generation.
Well, I presume what he was getting at was that the Negro businessman in St. Louis does not run his business in competition with the American market. I think it's no good to be the best Negro businessman. I think you've got to aim at being the best businessman in the town in order to gain the clientele that is out there.
As the open competition in the long run would benefit the Negro.
Yes, sirree. I do believe it.
As the short side, you try to protect.
Yes, and of course, you know, Negroes, too, have vested interests in segregation. Many.
That's what I'm talking about now.
I think that that is not best, that is not good for the development of the group. Now, you know, back during the early days of labor, when there was this cry about labor being communist, there was one classical cliché where you could hear expressed when a person was looking for advantages and working with the labor movement to gain them. Baby, this ain't for Moscow, this is for me. And many of the Negro people who feel that they are not capable of competing on the open market will perhaps take this position, that this is for me, and go at it from a subjective point of view. But objectivity ultimately is going to prevail. And those of us who can't compete on the open market are going to have to get out.
There are always casualties.
Yes, sir. In any sociological change, there are going to be casualties. And the American way, the person who builds the best mousetrap is going to get the business. And I think that Negro people have got to be prepared to take their chances on the open market and conduct their businesses as a business should be conducted and not rely upon any advantage that race might give them.
This is a problem, though, isn't it, for many people? For some people, anyway.
It's a problem for some people, but I think that when race is removed, though, it will not be a problem.
You mean it's a fear?
I think
it's justified.
I think it's a hint. You know, some people
yes,
see hints.
Yes. What did you think about the verdict in the Baron de la Beckwith trial?
Well, I'm pretty much a skeptic, I guess. But I accept the verdict in the Baron de la Beckwith trial as the second act of a well-written drama, with the actors playing their parts superbly. I think that the decision of a hung jury was made before the trial started. I think that the third act of the drama will show Beckwith a free man. The first act was the preliminary that went into the selection of the jury. I think
you are explaining that.
The selection of the jury was a tedious, on the surface, kind of a reaction. Mr. Waller took a lot of time, so did Mr. Lott, Mr. Cunningham, in securing 12 members of the jury. I think that it could have been done in 5 minutes and been over with.
It's never that way, though.
Well, no, it's never that way, but I'm saying that the stage that has been set for the Baron de la Beckwith trial that attempts to erase some of the mud from the name of Mississippi, at least we got a hung jury. Into my mind, all the time they took selecting the jury was a part of the act. And I think that when the trial is finally over, perhaps someday, like Marlon and Bryant wrote gave Look magazine a close-up survey of what had happened.
In the Till case.
That maybe the Saturday Evening Post will print Byron Della Beckwith's confessions and how there was this maneuvering back and forth.
Do you go as far as to believe, as some say, that even the taxi drivers who gave testimony that was damaging to Della Beckwith were giving fabricated testimony as to round out the drama, to give interest to the drama?
Well, I don't know. I think that the jurors, that's the question that's the position that I feel most strongly about, is that the time that they took for the verdict, the hung jury question, and there never has been a white man in Mississippi given a penalty in a capital crime for a crime against a Negro. And there have been situations perhaps where the web of guilt was wound much tighter. In the Till case, there was positive identification. You are the man.
In the Melton case, there was positive identification.
Sure. You are the man, yes.
Eyewitness.
Who pulled the trigger? At the service station.
Eyewitness at the Melton case.
That's right.
Yes, I was in Vandora just after that. I saw the widow and I talked to people around town.
Yes.
There was nobody in town that wasn't certain. Totally convinced of the guilt. What's his name? Who shot William Melton?
Well, Marlon was with the man that shot him. I don't recall this. Who pulled the trigger?
Oh, Kimball.
Kimball.
That's right. Cam B. Devil. Kimball shot it. Yes. And was acquitted on the first ballot, I think.
Yes.
Now, the Clarksdale paper, if I remember correctly, now please correct me if this is not true.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to remember that the Clarksdale paper, after the acquittal of Kimball, published on the front page a little editorial saying, in the Teal case, there might have been some excuse for failure to convict. In this case, there is none.
That's true.
We have flunked it.
That's right.
Now, was that a courageous act for that editor of this local paper to come out?
I think it was a courageous act. However, I think it reflects the thinking of a man that's no longer with the paper now, by the name of Guy Clark, who actually served as the advertisement manager. But he was the liberal force in the Clarksdale Press Register. I don't think you will find an editorial of that nature today.
What became of him?
He died. Died of a heart attack.
How old was he?
Well, Guy must have been around 45 when he died. He was an heir of the founders of the city, almost a real liberal. Very good man.
A man who, because of his social position, felt free to express his views.
His views, sure. And he'd been expressive all along, so it was nothing unusual about it.
Do you find that kind of maverick very often, the man of privileged position?
Not very often.
Uses privilege for independence?
Not very often. The fear of social ostracism, the fear of being called a nigger lover, and mostly the fear of the children being tagged, your daddy is a nigger lover.
That pressure.
That type of pressure keeps many people from being the kind of good men at heart that they are.
This is cutting back into history, but I'd like to ask you this one. Myrdal gives what he would consider the rational program for the reconstruction of the South in 1865.
This from the American Dilemma?
Yes. You remember the passage probably. He says that there should have been compensation for slaves to the now ex-owners. There should have been the expropriation of land for the resettlement and division of land. This land should have been paid for at a reasonable rate to the owners from whom it was expropriated. That the Negroes who received the land should have been charged something for it over a long period of time, as received supervision and control to prevent selling of it for a certain number of years until they had adapted themselves to the new system. Does this make sense? Because as we're looking back on impossible.
Well, we have. I'd like to answer it my way.
Please do. I just start this as a loud discussion.
Yeah. Now, I take the position that if the white community had accorded my grandma and my grandpa at the time they were freed from slavery recognition for the labor that they had given free, that they could have lived like millionaires forever because of this exploitation. I do not feel that, and I'm sure you recognize too, the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation did not free the slaves. The slaves had already been freed by this when Lincoln said if you drive the Confederates back from Tietam Creek, I'll free the slaves. And of course they were driven back. The signing of the emancipation, rather the winning of the Civil War, did not free the slaves. And of course that was somewhat an ambivalent position, because here the slaves are freed after the war. Their
the big thing that was wrong with the way the slaves were freed was none of us possessed the land. And I'd like to go back to perhaps the church would perhaps not agree with this, maybe. But in the leading of the children from Israel into what we call the Promised Land, to my way of thinking, was that Moses promised the children land, if you follow me. And of course, from the land comes all things that are conducive to life. And there was no place called the Promised Land as an area, but it was simply that they were promised land. And the analogy that I'm drawing is that after the Civil War, the Negro slaves were not even promised land. The Russians, when they freed their slaves, there was this land reform. England, when it freed its slaves, there was this land reform activity. And the American Negro was the only group that were freed from slavery during this particular area. Several countries freed their slaves during this general area. And the American Negro was the only group that was freed from slavery with no possessions whatsoever. And because of this situation, the progress of the American Negro has been slower than the Negroes in other communities. I have seen the plantation system grow. We have studied the growth of some plantations. And we have seen that as Negroes began to buy and acquire land after the Civil War, that it was not too long before the man who owned the land in the first place had connived and somehow secured all of the land generally back. And the Negro reverted from a slave to a tenant farmer or to a sharecropper. And his lot has not been that much better off. And I espouse right now, 1964, that we give serious thought to a land reform program in the South. And if you look at the way these mass plantations have come into being, how it has been conniving between circuit and chancery clerks, that where Negroes' property have been taken for taxes, where Negroes have been charged smaller amounts for tax than should have been charged over the years. And they take the position that it's the owner of the land's responsibility to be sure that he's properly taxed. And after some 50 or 60 years, this great tax debt comes against the land and the Negro can't pay it. And the land is confiscated.
Is that fairly common?
It's fairly common in the growth of the large plantations in this, in the South. So, although it appears to be in advocating land reform, taking from to give to others, but when we look at how come those that got, and those that do not have not got, it doesn't disturb my conscience morality at all to advocate that we become seriously considerators of a land reform program.
But a program with compensation or...
With compensation, yes.
You would have been for compensation to the southern landholders in 65?
I don't really know.
That's Midar's big point, of course.
Yeah, I don't really know. When I understand the amount of human labor for free that these plantation owners used, I don't really know whether they were entitled to anything else. Maybe at that time they actually had received more than they really should have.
Midar's point is there was a bankrupt economy. As little bankrupt as it was, in fact, was a contributing element to the present situation.
I think the big mistake we really made was removing the Northern troops too soon. I think that, I believe it was Rutherford Hayes, wasn't it?
That's right.
That made what we feel was a deal with the South. If you vote for me, I'll remove the federal troops.
The big sellout of 1876.
Yes. And I think more than compensation for the land, the big error was the premature removal of the troops.
Eleven years after the war was over.
Yes.
I hear now and then, particularly in Mississippi, the notion that only by some sort of threat of violence will real progress take place toward social justice for the Negro.
Well, that all depends on what you mean by threat of violence. You see, any act
let's explore that, then.
That the Negro takes toward gaining his rights as a citizen is considered a threat of violence by the white community. If it's going into a church and espousing the question of the right to vote in some communities, that provokes the white community to violence. If it's printing a handbill and passing it out in some communities, that's a threat to the tranquility and peace and a threat to violence of a particular community. So we have to define, you know, exactly what is a threat to violence and whether or not action guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States, the First Amendment that gives us the right of freedom of assembly and freedom of expression can be construed as threats of violence.
Yes, I realize that. I was going a step farther, but I must change the tape first.
We've had an hour?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't want to keep you up all night now. Right. It's almost 11 o'clock. Let me just take a little piece of the next tape. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Just a little piece. This is going too well. I hate to stop it.